Nisa Mbuna Vinaka, you're listening to Tangata o Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Koroe Hawkins. Coming up first.
At the grassroots level, people have basically been very, very upset.
We check out the latest on the Samoa election.
To be honest, I couldn't wait to get it because I know that we've all been shook by this whole pandemic.
Pacific countries press ahead with their AstraZeneca rollouts. Also, New Caledonia to hold its third independence referendum. And
it's better to work with a devil that you know than a devil that you don't know.
Papua New Guinea's working with Barrick Gold to reopen the Porgera mine. Samoa's election results have been confirmed with the caretaker Human Rights Protection Party, or HRPP, and the new Whātuatua Ile Atua Samoa o Tasi Party, or FAST, tied with 25 seats each in the 51-member parliament. The balance of power is held by a single independent MP, Tuala Tivanga Yosefo Bonifacio, who has yet to indicate whether he plans to be a king or queenmaker. The leader of the FAST party says final negotiations will be held over the coming week, as Dominic Godfrey reports.
Whātuatua Ile Atua Samoa Watasi, or FAST party leader, Fia Mea Naomi Mataafa, says she and the independent MP will meet in the next week. Fia Mea says she and Tuala Bonifacio agreed to wait until election results were confirmed, which happened last night. But Fia Mea says there may still be legal issues to be resolved.
Of course, there will be legal challenges, and they may in fact impact, on how the parliament sits. But that can only happen when it happens. But the business of formulating a government is the thing that needs to be done.
Lawyers are likely to head to court this week. Owa'u'o, Dominic Godfrey, Lene.
Whawhetai lava, Dominic. If Fia Mea Mataafa does emerge victorious from the tie, she would become Samoa's first woman prime minister and only the second Pacific Island woman leader, following in the footsteps of Marshall Islands' Hilda Haine. A win for FAST would also see the end of decades of political dominance by the formidable caretaker Prime Minister Tuilaepa Lupesoliai Sailele Malilingaoi, who is the longest-serving Pacific leader still living, the only other leader in his league being the late Ratu Sekamisesemara of Fiji. But regardless of which side forms government, this was a watershed election for Samoa, the closest in decades. Many political commentators have highlighted controversial pieces of legislation introduced by their caretaker government ahead of the election as the main reason it has lost so many supporters this year. But a local academic says the constitutional changes were only the tip of the iceberg.
I am Alcus Hazelman. I am the former pro-chancellor of the National University of Samoa, and I am a Mutai from the village of Falealupo.
Whawhetai lava, Ael, for joining us on the show. Were you expecting this result?
I too was very surprised. I was actually looking at HRPP winning, but I was hoping that FAST would at least get over 10 seats, to really make a good opposition. However, once the results came out, what is very, very clear is that Savai, in particular, truly voted on party, not necessarily on candidate. And I think from, being in Savai, I've listened to quite a few people. Savai is basically wanting a change, and that came out very clearly in the results. But, one thing that I will say is that regardless of who becomes government, I think it will be very foolish if they do not take into account the concerns of the people of Savai, because that, this has never been, seen before in my lifetime, to see, Savai really making a stand, as you've seen in the results from last week.
Yes, and again, regardless of who comes to power, already there is a form of change, isn't there, in the differing views that are now represented in the political space?
Well, I think so. And again, I'm speaking from Savai as well, because the people that I've, within my own family and within the community, is that at the grassroots level, people have basically been very, very upset especially in their representation of members of parliament coming from Sabai, and not necessarily making the concerns of Sabai, you know, being taken seriously.
And what kind of things are people, or have people been voicing that they are upset about?
Oh, well, very simple. I mean, for example, things like in education. I have many of my nephews and nieces who are attending the Itu Asau College. And one of the issues that have arisen is that due to the delay of the year 8 results, this is the primary SPECA exams, you have colleges like Itu Asau. You now have, you know, two classes of year 9s with 60 students per classroom. It's concerning, both from a student perspective and also from, you know, the health of the teacher. I mean, that's just one. Then you've got, you know, numerous health facilities around the island without a doctor, you know. And so, again, these are not new concerns that have been raised by people of Sabai for years. And, okay, I think the ministries have tried their best to have a rotational, to have doctors go, you know, around the island. But, you know, I think people in Sabai are saying, look, you know, these are what we want. And, you know, that came out very clearly, not only just the essential services. And it's something as simple as even the timetable of the boats, the inter-island ferries, because those seem to change and people get stuck at the wharf. And, these are people who are dependent on the bus services for them to get back to their families.
That was the former Pro-Chancellor of the National University of Samoa, Ayo Chris Hazelman. The World Health Organization is telling Pacific Island countries using the AstraZeneca vaccine they should continue with their rollouts. That's despite several European countries and Australia limiting its use because of safety concerns. Ireland is the latest country to restrict the vaccine to older people, after reported blood clots in younger age groups. Sally Round reports.
Many countries in the Pacific are only offering the AstraZeneca injection supplied by the COVAX facility, an international health grouping set up to ensure equitable vaccine distribution. The campaigns are gathering pace, including in Fiji, where hundreds of thousands in the tourism-dependent country are out of work because of COVID. There are reports of huge turnouts at vaccination hubs around the country this week. One who got the jab is 32-year-old Apakuki Nalawa. He says his main concern is getting borders open and his livelihood back.
To be honest, I couldn't wait to get it because I know that we've all been shook by this whole pandemic, and I think it's time for everyone just to move forward and get the vaccine and hopefully get the next shot in a few months and then get things rolling.
The authorities in Fiji say any hesitancy is easing off as more get vaccinated. Our correspondent in Suva, Lide Movono, says the government is pressing ahead with its campaign and opening it up to more people.
They have a lot of AstraZeneca that's coming out of the COVAX facility, and they do need to finish their stocks very quickly because the expiration date on these stocks is very near. There hasn't been much more information about where else they might get alternative vaccines from. For now, it looks like AstraZeneca is what we're getting in Fiji.
Tonga starts vaccinating around 2,200 frontline workers today with AstraZeneca. Our correspondent Mary Fornua says the country does not have the luxury of choice.
The alternatives require cold storage that we don't have. The alternatives are very hard to get. We'd be at the end of the queue. And there's a lot of other reasons. So Tonga hasn't jumped into this. They've been looking at this for months. And we're finally very pleased that there is some vaccine coming through.
Next week, Solomon Islands plans to start vaccinating 17,000 people along the border with Papua New Guinea, which has a serious outbreak of COVID-19. It's also using AstraZeneca, and a senior advisor to the health ministry in Solomon's, Dr. Yogesh Chaudhry, says people are being given extra information in light of the concerns.
Overall, the risk is extremely low. Our stance right now is to continue with the vaccination. If the WHO issues a statement it cannot be used in a certain age group, then of course we have an issue because all of our frontliners would be young people. We couldn't immunise them with AstraZeneca, so we would have to look for alternatives.
The World Health Organization says countries should continue to vaccinate with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has saved millions of lives and prevented serious illness. In a statement, it says the benefits outweigh the very rare potential risks.
The cases of blood clots with low platelets are all being investigated thoroughly. WHO will continue to inform the public, transparently and in a timely way, about any change in the assessment of risk of any vaccine or a change in our recommendation for their use. WHO works very closely with the governments in the Pacific to provide technical support. It's also important to note that health workers will continue to monitor experience, safety issues and impact of the vaccination program in the Pacific.
Meanwhile, Samoa's AstraZeneca vaccine rollout is being delayed a couple of weeks. The authorities there say they need time to double-check the 24,000 doses are all accounted for. This is Sally Round.
New Caledonia will have another referendum on independence from France by October next year. Twice since 2018, a majority has voted to stay French, but it's all but certain a third vote will be held. Walter Zweifel has been following the developments and joins me now. So this third independence referendum, it's a significant milestone to New Caledonia's decolonisation story, isn't it, Walter?
Yes, it is, in the sense that there was this Noumea Accord drawn up in 1998 that was meant to provide a 20-year period which would end New Caledonia's colonization. Let's remember that New Caledonia is on the UN list of territories to be decolonized since 1986. The territory was on the verge of open civil war a couple of times. There was an initial holding agreement called the Matignon Accords. 10 years later, no decision could be made on a referendum. So with the creation of the Noumea Accord, another 20-year window was created to see out this decolonization process. That accord provided for three referendums. The first one could be called at the earliest in 2014. For a number of reasons, practical, political, that was not done. At the very end of this 28th period was the first referendum. At the time, there was an expectation there was going to be an overwhelming majority to stay French. All predictions suggest there would be 70% or more who would wanted to stay French. The result was, however, only about 56.7% wanted to remain French. Under this Noumea Accord, a second referendum could be called, and that was then held in last October. And the majority wanting to stay French had reduced to just over 53%. A third vote is possible, or was possible, because under the Noumea Accord, a third of the Congress members can ask for a new vote. After the last vote, the pro-independent side thought it had enough support that it could possibly win, and they decided they wanted to see this Noumea Accord process run to the very end, which means there will be a third referendum.
So what exactly is this vote about? What are the questions here, Walter?
The question has been reduced to a very simple, do you want to have full sovereignty and become fully independent? The answer to this question means that the remaining powers held by France would be transferred to New Caledonia. They concern the military, justice, internal security, i.e. policing, border control, and also the monetary powers. It means the power to issue currency.
So who decides when this referendum will be held, Walt?
The exact date has to be determined by Paris. The time frame is given. It has to happen before October 2022, October next year. Now, complicating factor in this whole process is the French presidential election, which is due earlier next year. And there seems to be a strong feeling that the campaign for the French presidency should not coincide with a campaign for this independence in New Caledonia. The interesting aspects in the context are that the likely candidate challenging Emmanuel Macron will be Marine Le Pen. Marine Le Pen from the National Rally, or formerly National Front, is extremely popular in New Caledonia. The strongest showing that she had in the last election outside France was in the mainly southern part of New Caledonia, which is a stronghold of the anti-independence movement in New Caledonia.
Vinaka Walter, that was RNZ Pacific's journalist Walter Zweifel. Still to come on Tangata o Te Moana, Pacific rugby players lining up for Moana Pacifica and Fijian Drua teams. Government announces new funding for Pacifica Mental Health Services
and Pacific Trust proposes new location for multi-purpose Pacific venue in Wellington. But first, Papua New Guinea's government has reached agreement with Canada-based company Barrick Gold on plans to reopen the Porgera mine. The Enga Province mine closed a year ago when PNG's government denied Barrick and its joint venture partner in Barrick New Guinea Limited, Zijin Mining of China, a renewed mining lease. After months of difficult negotiations, a deal has been forged between the resource-rich Pacific nation and the forces of global capital, giving PNG majority ownership of the mine. Johnny Blades reports.
Previously, Barrick New Guinea had 95% ownership of the mining operation. The remaining 5% was shared between PNG's government and local landowners. Porgera was shut down due to a bitter joust between state and developer over PNG's move to seek better returns from the lucrative mine. But in the interim, thousands of people lost jobs, while the national and Enga provincial governments lost sorely needed revenue. With an economy in decline, PNG's government decided to be pragmatic, according to its mining minister, Johnson Tuke, at the bubbly agreement signing ceremony in Port Moresby.
Though Barrick has taken us to court, we work in harmony. It's better to work with the devil that you know than the devil that you don't know.
Under the agreement, ownership of the mine will transfer to a new joint venture, which will be 51% owned by PNG and 49% by Barrick New Guinea Limited, the mine's operator. The agreement also gives PNG stakeholders 53% of the economic benefits from the mine. Prime Minister James Marape says state negotiators secured the best deal they could for PNG.
Barrick and BNL will carry a cost of almost 65% in refinancing the opening of the mine, and we are contributing at 36% to restart up the mine going forward. A gold mine is capital intensive every time.
Mr. Marape says Barrick will cover PNG's share of the costs of reopening the mine interest-free.
Instead of us going to the bank borrowing at 6%, 7%, Barrick will advancing this 36% side that we're supposed to pay at 0% interest, and they'll be getting the cost into the mine. So PNG side contributes nothing into restarting Africa.
Barrick's chief executive, Mark Bristow, says reopening the mine is the priority, with PNG's recent rainy season having taken a toll on the open pit at Porgera. He says it would take at least 7 months to get the mine operational again, but all hands are now on deck.
For BNL, Barrick New Guinea, time is money, and we're off funding all the restart. So it's in our interest to work hard to get the mine to where it's producing revenue again.
The government still has to tend to outstanding matters of landowner approval and the establishment of development commitments under the venture. But the governor of Enga, Sir Peter Ipitas, says his province is happy the agreement has been reached after what he called a long journey. Until 2020, the Porgera mine operated for 30 years. Sir Peter has been Enga's governor for 23 of them.
Despite all the clashes that Mr. Bristow and our team had with you, it's all for the benefit of our people. It's not personal, but at the end of the day, we had to get somebody who would deliver for us and work with the devil I know, and that's Barrick.
It's unclear if Barrick will increase remedial efforts to address the legacy of rape and violence by its security contractors and other social problems on the mine lease area, or the mine's pattern of environmental destruction. But Mark Bristow cited a phrase used often in Chinese foreign policy when opening up about his company's strategy at Porgera.
And you know, people in the industry always talk about win-win. But what we took is the win-win concept and put it into an agreement. And, you know, when I joined Barrick, the one thing I said we have an objective of achieving is we want to be the most valued mining company in the world. That means we want to be acceptable for future generations.
Whether or not the agreement gets the approval of landowners isn't yet clear. The various landowner groups have unresolved grievances with the mining operations, including about environmental destruction, as well as rape and human rights abuses, which have affected the local community. Philip Marokon of the Akalitange Association of Landowners says they weren't involved in the agreement.
Barrick never seemed to pursue our issue, the state and the Barrick. So still this issue, outstanding issues are still pending, but they never even give us information in advance of what has been happened, and the agreement has already been signed.
Landowner opposition could yet prove obstructive for this major project, but the PNG government says its next focus is addressing those concerns before the reopening. This is Johnny Blades.
The phones are running hot with players lining up to return home and represent the Fiji Ndroa and Moana Pacifica in Super Rugby. It comes after New Zealand Rugby confirmed the two Pacific Island franchises have been awarded a conditional license to join an expanded competition from next year. Vinnie Wiley has more.
Fiji Rugby Chief Executive John O'Connor says a Super Rugby franchise on home soil will change the landscape of rugby in Fiji forever.
Every kid now who wakes up tomorrow has a new dream to be part of the Fijian Rua and to play professional rugby at home and not leave their families and go into a different environment. It's not only a dream for our players, you know, it's a dream for the match officials, coaches and so forth. It's a total pathway for us which has been missing for long.
The announcement is already having an effect, with O'Connor confirming some of Fiji's top sevens players have pulled the plug on plans to sign for overseas clubs.
They've indicated now that they would like to play for the Sevens and then switch over and a contract. So it's already starting. Players we would have lost after the Olympics now have the opportunity to stay back and switch to 15.
A number of Flying Fijians internationals playing abroad have already indicated they would move home to represent a local Super Rugby franchise. Pacific Rugby Players CEO Aidan Clark says both the Fijian Ndrua and Moana Pacifica, which will feature players of Tongan and Samoan heritage, will appeal to athletes who have never previously had the option to make a living in their own backyard.
Pacific Island players, whether they're from the islands or born in New Zealand, Australia, often will head off to apply their trade overseas through Europe and the UK. But now we've got an option here that's closer to home, and that means that them and their families have a fantastic opportunity to be involved in Super Rugby.
Moana Pacifica will initially be based in South Auckland, but there are plans to eventually play matches in Apia and Nuku'alofa. Tonga Rugby Union CEO Peter Harding says they haven't had a lot to do with the franchise so far, as they can't contribute much at the financial end, but they will be looking for help in developing a clear pathway for local players and coaches into the professional ranks.
It's about time we actually got opportunities for Tongans and Samoans, I suppose, Polynesian players to play for a team that represents what they represent as well. So, I mean, we're very, very enthusiastic about it, and we're looking forward to the team and the club or the franchise contributing to our pathway any way it can.
New Zealand Rugby says Moana Pacifica will not be a sixth New Zealand Super Rugby franchise, but will be able to contract up to three players who are not eligible to represent Samoa, Tonga or Fiji, which could include current or former All Blacks. Meanwhile, the Fijian Ndrua are prepared to relocate to New Zealand next season if COVID-19 prevents them from being able to travel internationally. A final sign-off on the two licences is expected by the end of June. Ko Vinnie Wiley, tēnei.
Mental health and addiction among New Zealand's Pacific community is the focus of $6.6 million of government funding to increase access to support services. The Minister for Pacific Peoples and Associate Minister of Health, Aupito William Sio, announced the new services in Wellington this week. The funding is part of the government's $455 million program to increase mental health and addiction services for all New Zealanders. Christine Ravoy has been following the story and joins me now. Bula Christine, so why do we need mental health and addiction services with a Pacific focus?
According to the government, Pacific people are more likely to experience mental distress, Koroi, than other New Zealanders, but Pacifica are also much less likely to reach out and seek support.
And you spoke to Minister Aupito, what did he say?
He said the importance of having services by Pacific and for Pacific could not be overstated. And he also said he will continue to lobby the government to dedicate at least 10% of the $455 million mental health fund. You know, that's more than $45 million. He's expected to commit that to a targeted Pacific approach.
In 2019, in the wellbeing budget, the government then announced that mental health was an issue that we needed to address. And that is the same view that I have for Pacific peoples, that we also must have new mental health and addiction services that is customized, that acknowledges our cultures and values, that is accessible to our communities.
So what will a targeted Pacific mental health service look like, Christine?
Well, according to Alpito, he's looking at a model of care that will reflect the values and the philosophies of, you know, the Pacific, and he wants to ensure that all these are linked to the Pacific and must be developed. He also says, you know, Croy, he also says that this includes services that, you know, appreciate the important role of social, cultural and the Ainga connections and the relationship Pasifika have with their land and their environment.
Most of our communities aren't aware of what mental health is. Our communities also are not aware. If you did have mental illness, where do you go for help? This is only the beginning. My intention is to make sure that we proliferate these kinds of targeted, customized services so that we're lifting the Pacific well-being of our Pacific communities.
I assume the government will be working with partners on this, partners within the community?
Absolutely. Five Pacific health providers will help deliver the mental health services in four DHB areas where there are like large Pacific populations. One of these providers is the Pacifica Futures. And, you know, in a statement, its chief executive, Debbie Sorensen, said she supports the minister's vision.
It is fantastic that the ministry recognises that we are the best people placed to serve our communities in our own way. Our communities are diverse, they have different needs and different ways of delivery. We are faith-based as we are family-anchored and we understand what we need.
Ms. Sorensen says with the new services, Pacifica will have more access to mental health as they can feel confident, and this will help them appreciate their Pacific languages, cultures and values.
For the first time, the voice of the Pacific is being heard. It was a quiet voice, but a voice nonetheless.
The Minister, Alpito Williams-Seo and Debbie Sorensen, they both agree this is the beginning of a bright future, Croy, for New Zealand's Pacific peoples.
Vinaka Vakalevu, Christine. That was RNZ Pacific journalist Christine Ravoy. A Pacific trust is hoping Wellington City Council will approve its new preferred site for a multi-purpose Pacific venue. The Fale Malai Trust updated the council this week on its progress with a focus on the site of this exciting new development for Pacifica. Moira Tula Patela has more.
The Malai Fale Trust plans to build an iconic, nationally significant building that will be a focal point for all New Zealanders to gather, learn and celebrate the contribution that Pacifica arts, cultures and histories make to New Zealand's national identity. At yesterday's meeting, there was a strong Pacific presence at the Wellington City Council chambers as Trust Chair Adrian Orr updated councillors and supporters. He said that the Trust's preferred site is now Frankerts Park on Wellington's waterfront. Last March, Wellington City Councillors gave the Trust the green light to work on a Whale Malai or cultural centre at a proposed central site. But a company employed by the Trust to look at engineering issues advised against the original site. Here's the company's managing director, Maurice Clark.
The main reason was it was too cramped for a start, but it was smack bang in the middle of a view shaft. The view shaft, when you come out of the railway station and you look up to Parliament, it was going to block the view of Parliament, and they're embodied in the district plan.
The Trust then explored alternative sites with greater land area and fewer planning and resource consent hurdles. It now considers that Frankerts Park is an ideal solution, particularly given the strong relationship to the site to the sea and local tangata whenua. Here's Trust member Lua Manuvao, Dame Winnie Laban.
At Frankerts Park, it's the ocean. We're an oceanic culture, and also we have a connection to mana whenua, te ate awa and tangata whenua. New Zealand needs to finally own its identity as a Pacific nation, and this is symbolic of how we can celebrate that.
Sasha Gibb of the New Zealand Festival of the Arts was there to support the Malai Whānau Trust. She says she's excited about what the new multi-purpose venue could offer Pacific artists.
We need more of those spaces where, you know, our artists can come together in a space that, you know, that they have real ownership over, to be able to have talanoa, to be able to present works in a space that our communities, you know, feel that they also have a stake in and ownership over.
A huge number of young Pacifica were at the meeting. Aaron Yensienthiang, the Academic Officer for the Pacific Students Council at Victoria University, says the Malai Whānau would showcase Wellington's commitment to Pacific people.
You'd have to be pretty ignorant to not see the massive contribution that our Pacifica people have to the greater society of New Zealand. I think that this physical representation is just something that kids growing up can see and be like, oh, that's the beehive. Oh, this is the Whale Malai.
And another young Pacifica, Edwina Harris, who's the president of the Pacifica Council at Victoria University, says having such a Pacific space is long overdue.
I'm a New Zealand-born Pacific Islander, and I think that this is really important to our sense of place and sense of belonging. Yes, we can have, you know, churches and stuff, but there are a lot of us who don't associate with church. So to have such a structure that represents all Pacifica culture where we're all welcome, it's long overdue.
The government allocated $10 million in the 2020 budget to the project, with $1 million immediately available for planning and design work, including securing a suitable site. The trust will now begin fundraising. Ko Moeretula e Pitaila tēnei.
That was our Tonga correspondent, Kalafi Moala. And that's Tangata o Te Moana for this week. Remember, you can download us free to your mobile device on any podcast platform. And if you're using Apple, please leave us a rating so others can also find us. Tōwhā soifua.